Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. My name is Karen, and today I'm once again joined by Kristen.
Hello, everyone.
And you can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and at Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We have a very full episode today, so we are going to plug right along.
I think this might be the longest doc yet.
It could be. We're going to not try to make it the longest episode yet.
There's just a lot of information.
Yes.
So it looks long, but it's not going to be that long.
Yeah, yeah. We have high hopes for this being an efficient and contained episode. We'll see what happens. Okay, so as usual, we want to get into news and updates first, because there actually has been quite a bit since we came out last week. The first and biggest thing always is there was a blog update, November 13th blog update from Rick's blog, and right now, the big thing here is that there are no immediate plans for a Daughter of the Deep sequel, but he also said that doesn't mean there couldn't be any in the future. I actually really like when authors do this, if they're like, yeah, I didn't plan a sequel for this, but I won't say no if something comes to me.
I mean, yeah, I 100% agree with you. Like, not closing the door. Like, it's one thing if there's a character that pops into your mind, big world, and you're like, this is the only story I'm telling, it's done. Like, it always makes me sad, because especially, like, a giant, you know, incredible world like that for Daughter of the Deep, like, it would make me really sad if that was the only one. But I'd understand if that's, you know, but I do love it when an author says, I'm not closing any doors, because you never know. Like, you never know when he starts doing, you know, starts working on the script for the movie, because we know it's already been optioned, and maybe some ideas start popping in his head, and he's like, oh, I gotta write this. Oh, this would be really cool. Like, I really want to write this, and, ooh, think of the research I could do. Maybe they'll let me go on a submarine. Like, I can see Rick getting, like, adventure ideas in his head and, like, going from there. So, yeah, I'm glad that it's not completely off the table. It's off. No,
same thing.
I'm glad it's still an idea. It's still possible. That's all that matters.
And he basically said, like, he's just got a lot of other things going on that need his attention right now, which is kind of why he doesn't plan on doing a sequel. So maybe in the next couple of years, once all of these things come out, once things have settled down a little bit, he'll return to it. So that's just really nice to know.
Yeah, and I'm sure Disney, once the movie starts getting made,
they're
like,
not gonna say no.
Like, a sequel? Yeah, you should get a writing on that. Here, let's, you know, throw them in advance. Throw more money at Rick. We can only hope.
Yeah, exactly. So the other thing is that we found out two of the Rick Riordan Presents books have release dates, like solid release dates, and official synopses now. I'm not going to read the synopses because they're kind of long, but if you go to his blog, which I'll link to in the show notes, you can find them there. The first one is that on October 4th, 2022, The Lords of Night, a Shadow Bruja novel by J.C. Cervantes is going to come out. That is the Stormrunner spinoff, so that's pretty exciting and a really cool title.
And that's my birthday?
Yes, it is.
So now I feel like I have to read The Stormrunner this next year. Like, I have to at least get through those books, because I feel like I need to.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. The other one is Serwa Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting by Roseanne A. Brown, also has the synopsis, and that one is officially coming out September 6th, 2022. And that's a brand new series. We haven't gotten anything from her yet. She's one of the new writers, so the fact that it's coming out in less than a year, I'm really excited about that. And that was one of the ones we were like, Guide to Vampire Hunting, that sounds really exciting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, the biggest news here, obviously, has to do with the Nico book. sorry to everyone, but we're just going to be really excited about the Nico book, basically, until it comes out.
I'm pretty sure anybody listening to this podcast is right there with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, so exactly. We're so, right now, Rick's editor, Steph Lurie, has the Nico book, has Mark Oshiro's first draft of the Nico book. Once she gets through it, she will pass it on to Rick, who will do his pass. So we are really getting through the process. We know that the book is 117,000 words right now, which is pretty big.
Like, I mean, yeah.
I mean, that's got to be like 450, 500 pages, I think.
I'm thinking of all the articles I've written in my life that were 1,000 words, and I'm like, it's 117 times yeah. longer than that. Like, that's not helpful at all, but that's what my brain's yeah. doing right now.
I think, like, when I typically write a book, it's about 60,000 words, and I think that usually ends up being around 250 pages. So this is twice that.
400, yeah. 450, yeah.
So... Whew. That's pretty big. Now, I'm sure that will get cut down, like,
yes.
100%. So we'll just have to see what it ends up being. But I think that's pretty exciting.
It's fun to know that Mark is like, I had to put in all the things, yeah. okay? It's a long book right now, but we'll see where it gets at the end. Like, it feels very on message to it, like, because he was like, oh, I'm putting everything
yeah. in there. Yeah.
It's cute.
So, unfortunately, we did not get any news about the Percy Jackson television show, and we probably won't hear any big news about the television show until 2022. We were very excited for Disney Plus Day, and a lot of really cool things came out. So if you're like a huge Marvel fan and stuff, go check out their thread because we are very excited for some of those properties. We thought we were going to get some Percy Jackson television show news, like maybe key artwork or just the official green light.
Yeah.
That did not happen, unfortunately, yeah. but that's okay. You know, we'll be patient for as long as we can.
As far as anyone knows, things are still chugging along.
Yeah, yeah.
No news is not bad news. Yeah. No news just means no news.
And Rick said in the blog that, like, they're working on the, I think it was the fourth episode script right now. Everything's still going along as it should.
Yeah.
They're not going to, I think they're going to try to get that finished by the new year. And by early next year, we should have the official green light. Everybody's still happy. So, like, yeah, this is definitely not bad news. It's just not the big grand announcement we were right. hoping for.
And I would say by the time they finish the fourth script and by the time we start to get into, like, you know, the actual green light February, we'll probably start hearing stuff about the cast, too.
Yeah.
Because if they're planning, hopefully, very loosely to start shooting in the summer,
they would need a cast.
So, like, I would say February, March, we'll probably start hearing some casting information, yeah. and we'll get more and more as it gets closer to filming.
Yeah, and on November 7th, Becky tweeted that she and Rick reviewed some casting callback tapes. Ooh. So, I mean, that's pretty exciting. That basically means that, like, the people who have submitted cast tapes so far of them auditioning for Percy and maybe some other characters, they've been reviewing those and they're going to see which ones they want to call back to do, like, maybe bigger tapes or actually come in for physical auditions and stuff.
And eventually chemistry reads with yeah. other actors to make sure that they, you know, that it just reads well, that you're getting the right dynamic and that they work together yeah. really well.
So. And especially if you're planning for a TV show to, you know, optimistically have 5 seasons, you really need to make sure that chemistry is there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. So we won't actually get any real casting news for a while. But this is good news. And again, everything's just plugging away like it should. So that was basically the blog post. Not anything, like, totally spectacular, but I just love being kept up to date on everything, and it's nice to just be like, oh, yeah, everything's fine.
And it's straight from Rick's mouth, so yeah. we can trust it and just, exactly. you know, keep moving.
Yeah. If you guys enjoy Daughter of the Deep and want to see either artwork or a few more, like, basically... There are spotlights now for Nalina, Esther, and Gemini. We got one for the Nautilus a while back, so you guys can go see that. I'll put the links in the show notes for that. We also found out that The Last Fallen Star is finally in New Zealand, which means Gracie Kim can actually go see her book in real life.
I saw that and was like, wait a minute. It's from... She's... wait.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, I was so confused that she hadn't, like, seen her book, but now yeah. I'm glad it's a reality now.
Yeah, she can go into a bookstore and see it in real life, and that's always got to be such a cool feeling.
To be, like, the first thing I would do is, like, go buy a copy.
Yeah,
like,
right? Exactly.
Oh, it's my book.
Yeah. Yeah. total random piece of news slash information. There is a Lightning Thief musical karaoke, like, set of tracks on Spotify. There's, like, 5 songs on there. Aww. That's, like, the karaoke tracks for them, which I thought was, like, really random but cool. So yeah, if you guys want to practice belting out the lyrics to those songs, now you can.
Or if you want to test your friends and their knowledge of the lyrics, put on the karaoke track and be like, all right, prove it.
See, Kristen's a very good singer. I am not, so I'm sorry, I will never do karaoke with you. You can do it for the both of us.
This is the problem with being a decent singer, is nobody ever wants to karaoke with you. They're just like, nope. You can go sing. Go for it.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
Okay, so last on the news front, which I guess isn't really news, but is something related that I thought was really cool. Becky tweeted about an article that went up on Gawker called Forget Horse Girls, Embrace the Mythology Freak. And as, you know, your resident mythology freaks, I thought that this was really fitting. And I read the article. Did you get a chance to read the article?
No, I did not.
Okay. It's very good, and it definitely hit some things for me. So I feel like it's very accurate. It was written by Jenny G. Zhang, which I recently learned, and so did the people in the YouTube comments of the pronunciation guide video, that this is how you would say Frank's last name. Like, all of the comments were like, oh, Frank, I'm so sorry, I've been pronouncing your name wrong this whole time. And there were people in there like, who's Frank? And I was like, oh, you guys just don't know. But it was so funny to see it full of Percy fans.
I now feel so badly.
Like, Frank. We're trying our hardest with pronunciations for, you know, cultures and languages that we are very unfamiliar with. But now we know.
Hey,
so
learning is important.
Yes,
and every day we learn something. And today I learned that I've been saying Frank's name wrong for a long time.
For a very long time. Same. Okay, so there were, like, basically 3 major parts of this article that just really stuck out to me that I wanted to mention. And I think it's actually good that you haven't read the article yet, because then I can kind of, like, tell you about them.
Okay.
Basically, the article was like, okay, what do mythology freaks call themselves? Are they, like, lore heads or things like that? Which I kind of liked all of the names. And I think she kind of settled on mythology freak, but it was basically like, okay, all of those people who read mythology as kids, where are they now? What are they up to? How did that influence their life? And I thought that was really interesting, because she actually did, like, a Twitter survey and got, like, 35 people to respond. And there were some commonalities between all of them. So it was nice to just feel seen and represented and going, oh, yeah, we're actually doing a lot of the same things. One of the people who responded was Nick Augustine, 26, who works in public relations, and said that the fact that Greek stories are super gay meant a lot to him growing up, and he figured out his own identity and sexuality. He joked, I think the myth kids and the lore kids all ended up queer and working in media. Not gonna lie, feels very relevant to my life and a lot of my friends' lives. Mm-hmm. So that one's correct so far. The next part was like, or perhaps neurodivergent. I'm ADHD, and I feel like that's the kind of thing that is really easy to hyper-focus on and get lost in, that sort of escapist world, said writer Jennifer Barton, 39. Said the writer, so, you know, again, very relevant. Yeah. It's an endless obsession. You can keep unraveling more and more layers, no matter which sort of folklore you're diving into. There's something about it that is able to capture my constantly moving, chaotic mind. And that's so true. When you think about mythology, one of the things that's very difficult about it, but is also kind of amazing, is there are different versions of every story.
Yeah.
And they've been kind of warped over the years to kind of fit certain people or certain experiences. And that's the sort of thing that, like, you can pull from, like, with all of these stories that we read with Rick and Rick Riordan Presents, they pull certain aspects up from it and, like, make it their own. And it never ends. And I love that. There's so much to think about.
Yeah, I feel like the generation before us was the generation of fairy tales that it were being retold and pulled apart. And you had all of those Disney classics that came out somewhere between, like, the 60s to the late 80s. Like, you had Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty, and all of those were a product of that time. So I feel like back then it was fairy tales that were being deconstructed and, you know, rebuilt, and you had things Disneyfied. But then you also had, like, dark versions of Little Mermaid coming out, and, like, you know, there was a lot of fairy tale reimagining. We still have some of that now, but I feel like our generation grew up in a time when things were so uncertain and weird that we had either post-apocalyptic things or really deep mythology.
Yeah.
Like, I will never stop thinking about, like, the how taken we all were with the world of Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. Like, not even, like, the school, but, like, unraveling all the different jobs you could have and, like, looking at the grand scheme of things. So it was, like, I think that whole idea of having an entire universe to escape into was really, really common. Like, everyone was reaching for that. So I think that's another aspect to it.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Another part of the article talked about how mythology, whether you're talking about classic mythology with Greek, Roman, Egyptian, Norse, like any of those, or mythology and world building in, like, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, even Percy Jackson, it's a form of escapism. And when you have a world that is so different from our own, that has different rules or different creatures, different ways things work, you just can't stop thinking about it and trying to apply it to your own life, especially for kids like us who were nerdier and quieter and who liked reading and just kind of getting away from the real world and everything. I lived for that stuff. I mean, that's exactly why I loved Harry Potter. So yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the last part of this was, this little paragraph says, others speculate that what drew them to tales of divine beings and enchantment are the inherent threads of power and metamorphosis. Quote, gods and things that can change at the snap of your fingers. This is magazine staffer Nawal Arjini's words, 26 years old, that are so out of reach beyond the pages of a story. So basically, the idea of gods being these all-powerful beings who could change your life at the snap of finger, that's exactly why I liked that sort of thing. That's why I read Harry Potter, too. Like, one day you wake up and you get the letter. Hi, Callie. One day you wake up and get a letter in the mail and everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I lived for that kind of thing. And the idea that gods could also mess with your life was not the greatest, but it kind of is what it is at that point.
Well, and if you're stuck, like, if you're stuck at home because your mom, you know, both of your parents are working and so you're home by yourself, like, thinking about something stepping in and messing up your whole world and, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not the worst idea. Like, thinking that, you know, you could get a letter from Hogwarts and it messes up your entire life. Or if you, you know, all of a sudden that, you know, that teacher that's been driving you crazy your entire life is actually a monster. Like, you know, and you get sucked off into Percy Jackson's world. Like, you have to go to Camp Half-Blood. Like, that whole idea of, like, one thing changing and boom, your entire life is different. And you don't have to sit here and deal with the annoying reality of our world. Like, that's all. Yeah. It's intoxicating. It's crazy.
It is. Yeah. So I highly, highly recommend reading that article. And I'll try to remember to link to the tweet, too. So if you want to, like, tweet at her or anything. I thought it was a really good article and, like, obviously super relevant to our lives. So there you go. Okay, we're going to get into the big part of this episode, which today we are going to be talking about the Rick Riordan Presents author's other series. So this is not the series that they've written for Rick. This is the ones that they've written before, during, after they've written those books. So everything not related to Rick Riordan Presents, we're going to try to talk about it. Now, basically what we're going to do is go through each author and talk about series and standalone novels that they've written. We'll discuss some short stories and anthologies, especially if they were the ones that, like, collected them. But Let me tell you, there is a lot of stuff here. Some of these authors are very prolific, and we could not talk about them all. So I'll be linking to, like, their Goodreads pages and stuff if you really want to do a deep dive and try to read everything they've written. Good luck. It will take you a long time, but it will be a lot of fun along the way.
I will say, anthologies have had a rebirth in the last, like, 5 years. Even in the romance community, like, I can't even name all of the anthologies that have come out because I haven't even heard of half of them. Mm-hmm. Like, there's constantly, you know, good charitable causes that they want to write something to benefit, or just, you know, a group of authors that are like, hey, we all write the same thing, let's do an anthology. Like, they're popping up right and left these days. So, it does not shock me that there's a lot of anthologies.
Yeah. And anthologies are really cool, too, because they usually have a common theme. So maybe they're all stories about love. They're all stories about death. Or, like you said, they're all stories maybe about, like, a specific perspective in the world. Like, you know, from, I think Kwame did one that was from Black male writers, basically, mm-hmm. and, like, their experiences in the world.
Yeah.
They could be really cool, and it's a great way to discover new authors. Just like Cursed Carnival was an anthology full of mythological stories, now you've read some of them, you've got an idea of their style, and you kind of know which ones you might want to jump into first regarding their other series. So, yeah, anthologies are really cool. But there are a lot of them, and these authors have written a lot of short stories in them, so it's a lot. We're going to do our best. Basically, we're going to just go every other, we're going to pick an author and tell you about it, tell each other about it, and hopefully you'll find something that you think sounds interesting, and then you can go read it, and hopefully enjoy it.
All the books, that's basically
all the books, yeah, so many. Okay, so we're going to start with Roshni Chokshi first. She wrote the Pandava Quintet / Arusha books. Her first series, and the one that I've heard of most, really, was The Star-Touched Queen. The first book came out in 2016, and she's done... There are two other books in this series, A Crown of Wishes in 2017 and Death and Night, which was a novella in 2017. Sorry, so two major books, one novella, and then Star-Touched Stories, which was a collection that also came out in 2017. So really, it's a duology. So, Star-Touched Queen is basically about Maya, who is forced into a marriage of political convenience, but as she enters her new roles, she finds her voice as a queen and love as a wife, but her new city is full of secrets that span reincarnated lives, and she must unravel them all to protect everyone she loves, including herself. Sounds very good and exactly like something I would read.
Yeah, it does. It sounds a little more, like, adult.
A little bit, yeah.
Than, I mean, we're used to Rick and anybody who touches things that are, you know, in the Rick Riordan universe. It's usually middle grade or, you know, even YA. This definitely sounds like it could be more of an adult novel. So if you are one of the many 20-plus people that read all kinds of younger YA stuff and whatever, this might be interesting.
Yeah, I think it is technically a YA novel, but you're right, considering she's, like, a wife and, you know,
a queen and,
yeah, I think that it's probably one of those that's, like, a slightly older YA, which I always like reading. Roshni's also written the Gilded Wolves trilogy. That starts with the Gilded Wolves, which came out in 2019, and then she did the Silvered Serpents in 2020 and the Bronze Beasts in 2021. So that's also a finished series, if that's important to you. I know a lot of people are like, I'll just wait until the series is over so I don't have to wait between books. This is really cool because The Gilded Wolves takes place in 1889 in Paris. A treasure hunter is offered the reward of a lifetime, so he gathers an unlikely band of experts. What they find may change the course of history. This definitely gives me Six of Crows vibes. I watched Shadow and Bone. I haven't read any of the books or anything, but just, like, the time period, the way that it's, like, an unlikely band of experts and, like, you know, interesting people definitely gave me that vibe. And I actually started this book. I read, like, one or two chapters and then got busy and had to put it down. So I think I own at least two of these. I really should pick them up at some point.
I was going to say, they sound familiar, so I have a feeling they exist in our apartment.
Yes, they do, for sure. Okay, so then Roshni has also written some short stories, and I really wanted to include these because they actually sounded amazing. The first one she did came out in 2015, and this is called The Wisha Kanya's Choice. I hope I said that right. And it's about a widow who is offered a choice to become a Wisha Kanya, an assassin, a poison maiden whose very touch is toxic, and is sent on her first mission, which becomes a legend. I mean, very much like an adult kind of, you know, but very much like Arusha, the Hindu mythology and everything. So I thought that was really cool. She also did one called The Wives of Azhar in 2015. And the description of this one was kind of funny. It said, Rosh never understood why Bluebeard killed all of his wives. So this short story is an exploration into that question, which I thought was like kind of random, but I really liked it.
Yeah.
She also did a short story for 1,000 Beginnings and Endings in 2018. Ellen O and Elsie Chapman from We Need Diverse Books compiled this anthology, and it's basically star-crossed lovers, meddling immortals, feigned identities, battle of wits, and dire warnings. This is the stuff of fairy tale myth and folklore. So if you're into Rick Riordan Presents, you should probably read this anthology because I'm pretty sure she is not the only person who has written in this anthology that's from Rick Riordan Presents. Uh-huh. So there's a couple like that where, you know, some people I'm like, oh, you guys knew each other before you started writing here. That's pretty cool.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Kristen, you're up.
All right. I will be discussing the many titles and work of J.C. Cervantes, who we know as the author of Stormrunner and the accompanying books. The first one is Tortilla Sun. Why did I have trouble saying tortilla?
Tortilla.
My brain was like, foreign word, must not pronounce. Okay. Okay, yeah. The first one is called Tortilla Sun.
There was conflicting notes.
I was going to say, when did you do this out on purpose? Like, oh, let's make Kristen's first one kind of weird. Like, no. it either came out in 2010 or 2014. We don't know.
Amazon and Goodreads said two different things, so I just put them both in there. I'm sorry.
So it was either, yeah, it either came out in 2010 or 2014. We are not entirely certain, but it exists. And Tortilla Sun is about 12-year-old Izzy, who spends the summer with her grandmother in a New Mexico village and discovers long-buried secrets and a hint of magic. I mean, that sounds cool.
And it sounds a lot like Stormrunner. Like, it's still the same sort of age and everything. Not quite the same, obviously, but, like,
yeah,
writing similar things.
Yeah. The next two, it looks like they both come out next year in 2022. The first one, Flirting with Fate, is her young adult debut about a girl named Ava who's too late to her Nana's deathbed. So the woman's blessing doesn't hit its mark, and Ava is forced to befriend the boy who accidentally received it instead so her grandmother can find peace.
Yeah.
That is kind of insane.
It is.
Like,
by the way, reducing some of these books down to, like, one or two sentences was impossible. Oh. So they might sound really weird to you guys.
Yes, and all of the credit goes to Karen because I did not do any of these. So she's a superhero.
I volunteered, so don't send Kristen any hate but mail or anything.
It's a lot of work. And
it took
can't
me
even
a long time.
Yeah, I can't even. So it's totally fine. No, that whole idea sounds really cool, though. Like, a blessing missing its mark. Like, that just...
Yeah, even from the full description, I was like, wait, what exactly is going on? But it sounds really interesting.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And the other book that's coming out next year is called Fractured Path. It is book 3 in the Mirror series, which was started by Julie C. Dow with Broken Wish. The series follows the four generations of a family, both blessed with magical powers and plagued by a curse that haunts them.
This was really cool because this is not the only author who has done something like this, but I haven't seen a lot of things like this where it's a series of however many books that actually go together, but they're all written by different authors, which I think is such a cool idea. And let me tell you, guys, go look for the Mirror series and read about them because it sounds so cool. Each one of them takes place in a different time period in a different city, and it's got magic and curses and, like, all this kind of stuff. Like, I really want to read this series.
Yeah, they sound really cool. Plus, I mean, mirrors are always fascinating to me, especially when they're used in fiction. Like,
yeah.
Mirror universes and mirror worlds and broken mirrors and all the things that can come from them, yeah, and the curses and blessings and weirdness. Yeah, it all sounds fascinating. So yeah, I'm there.
Okay, so Yoon-Ha Lee is next. Now, Goodreads says he has 171 distinct works.
What?
Yeah. So this...
That was my mind exploding.
We are not going to go through all of them. I did my best with him because he is a very, very prolific writer.
I mean, I thought romance writers wrote a lot.
Yeah. Now, that's the thing about sci-fi writers, too, is they tend to write a lot of short, yep, stories and novellas. They tend to write, like, stories for magazines and stuff, and that's what he did a lot. So it's
sci-fi is another genre that they just, yeah, they never stop, like they much. Just keep writing, and it just, yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
So Yoon-Ha Lee's main series is The Machineries of Empire, and there are also short stories set in this universe. Like a lot of his other works are within this universe, they're just short stories, but this is a trilogy. It starts with Nine Fox Gambit, which came out in 2016, and then Raven Stratagem in 2017, and Revenant Gun in 2018, so another finished series. Nine Fox Gambit follows Captain Kel Charis, who must align herself with an undead general in order to besiege a fortress, win an impossible war, and redeem herself in front of her superiors. Sure. Why not? Zombies, sci-fi, like, honestly, that does sound like something I would
Karen
read.
Karen does like the zombies.
Yes, I do. And, by the way, Yoon-Ha Lee wrote Dragon Pearl, will also be writing Tiger Honor. So, lots of sci-fi here, basically, is what I'm trying to say. He also writes a lot of, like, non-binary characters and stuff. Tiger Honor is going to be about a non-binary character. And Phoenix Extravagant, which came out in 2020, this is another cool one. A non-binary painter who wants to stay out of politics is hired by the government to paint mystical sigils that will animate their automaton soldiers, but then they learn the source of the magical pigments, steal a mighty dragon automaton, and find a way to fight. Kristen's face right now is hilarious. She's like,
there's
what?
A lot going on
there
in there.
There is, yeah.
Hired by the government to paint mystical sigils.
Right?
That just right there, I'm like, okay, this, yeah, is really cool. Animate their automaton soldiers. Learn the source of the pigments, steal a mighty dragon automaton. Like Festus.
Is that you?
Yeah, my brain immediately goes, okay, that's Festus. Got it. Yeah. Moving on. Yeah, no, that is insane, but sounds really, really cool. That's, yeah, all I got.
It does. It sounds amazing, and I really want to read it, to be honest.
Just start making a list and just, yeah, adding all the things.
So Yoon has a lot of titles to his name, and I'm going to link to his Wikipedia page because they list them there beautifully. Not all of the authors have a Wikipedia page, so it was a little hard. I'm really sorry, by the way, if I missed anything. I did my best. But Yoon's Wikipedia page was super, super helpful. One of the things I wanted to talk about, though, aside from all of his short stories, was a collection that he did called Conservation of Shadows, and I'm directly quoting from the synopsis here. It says, there's no such thing as conservation of shadows. When light destroys shadows, darkness does not gain in density elsewhere. When shadows steal over Earth and across the sky, darkness is not diluted. Sounds very creepy and cool.
Yeah.
And Kristen's like, creepy, yes. Cool, I don't know.
It's just a very scary concept.
Yeah. Like, but this is a collection of short stories that he wrote, and yeah, I thought it sounded really cool. So maybe that could be one that you guys want to pick up.
Yeah, for sure. All right, next on our Happy Hit Parade is Carlos Hernandez, which Karen has a fun fact about.
Yeah, okay, so this blew my mind. I was looking him up, and I was having a little trouble sorting out, because he's another person who's written a lot of sci-fi short stories in anthologies and magazines, and so I was having trouble tracking everything down, and I went to, I think it was his website. Apparently, he got his PhD at Binghamton University. That's where I grew up. Like, I didn't go to Binghamton University, but, like, growing up, my address was Binghamton, New York.
Yeah.
I didn't know this, and I already love Carlos, and now I feel like I have to tweet him or something and just be like, I know where that is.
Be like,
please be friends with me.
Carlos, next time I'm home visiting my mother, we should totally meet up somewhere near Bangham. Like, I'm sure he doesn't live anywhere near there now,
but I think
it would just be so fun.
In New York still. I don't know if it's New York City or what. I don't remember. But he knows where Binghamton is.
Which is just so cool. So
maybe we can grab a coffee sometime.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got very excited.
I mean, if anybody ever graduated with a degree from my school, which is not that small, but also not that big, I would be equally, like, jazzed. Yeah. So I totally...
Yeah. Also, like, not a lot of people know Binghamton, New York. Right. It's not Syracuse or Albany or any, or, like...
Right. I mean, Bowling Green, Ohio is not on anybody's, like, long list of things, so I definitely get it.
Yeah.
Okay, the first work is The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria, a collection of science fiction short stories about people who have assimilated and are trying to reclaim their lives.
This is, like, this was, like, his big thing. Basically, everybody kind of talks about this one collection.
Gotcha. I mean, it's...
Sounds cool.
The title itself, besides being a mouthful, makes you, like, interested. Like, what is quantum Santeria? Like, it's a lot. It's a lot to wrap your mind around.
And with somebody who writes science fiction and fantasy, especially short stories, they get weird.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure it's a lot of fun. Or maybe not, because... Short stories can also be very sad sometimes.
Yes. Carlos has also written a lot of science fiction short stories in other anthologies and magazines. So if, again, take a look at their the Goodreads page and take a gander. Maybe you'll find something that really sticks out to you.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so next up is Kwame Mbalia, who wrote the Tristan Strong series. His big one was Black Boy Joy. That came out this year in 2021. It's a collection of short stories about the power of joy and the wonders of Black boyhood, and a whole bunch of Black male writers wrote stories for this. I've been seeing it go around a lot, and especially little boys reading this book, I can't imagine how amazing they must feel.
Oh, yeah.
So, and the cover is just really striking and beautiful. I think that one's pretty cool.
It's a cool title, too.
It is. It's just cool. Yeah, and especially, like, I don't want to get on too much of a tangent, but there's a lot of talk about, like, anger in the Black community and, you know, all of the terrible things that happened to them, rightfully so, and those stories should exist somewhere, but to be able to write about Black boy joy, I think is something that is just really beautiful, and I think it's already been making a lot of rounds and a lot of people really happy, so that's cool.
Yeah.
He also wrote Last Gate of the Emperor in 2021. This is an Afrofuturist adventure that takes place in a mythical Ethiopian empire. Yared is a star player in an underground augmented reality game called The Hunt for Caleb's Obelisk. When he logs in with his real name, the city is attacked and his uncle disappears.
Wow.
Yeah, it sounds really cool, though, and honestly, this one has kind of a Rick Riordan Presents, like, vibe to the cover and stuff. Like, I think it would fit. I mean, this isn't necessarily about mythology, but it fits very much in that realm. I was going to say,
it certainly feels very, like...
Yeah.
It might not necessarily fit exactly into the mythology-based, you know, middle grade kind of thing, but it sounds very... appropriate for this, like, for the same group of readers.
Yeah,
so that makes definitely lots of sense.
And once again, he's written a lot of short stories and other anthologies. I feel like we're gonna say that for, like, every author, but I just want to make sure you guys know that if you want to go looking for something short to read.
Yeah, like, other things exist.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, next up is Taylor K. Mejia, who wrote the Paola Santiago books. The first title we want to talk about is We Set the Dark on Fire.
Very cool title.
Right. Like, I feel like it just, it has some punch. Like, duh. That book came out in 2019. There's a second book entitled We Unleash the Merciless Storm, which came out in 2020. 2020, Merciless Storm.
Yeah.
And,
too
that,
real.
That kind of fits. But yeah, no, another great title. Like, it definitely paints a picture and has you thinking things. But yeah, as far as we set the dark empire, at the Medio School for Girls, young women are trained to either run their husband's household or raise his children. Dani's parents have forged papers to get her into the school so she can rise above her station, but when a rebel group asks her to spy for them, everything could be put at risk.
This is one of the ones where, like, the synopsis was a lot more than this.
Yeah.
But I tried my best to get it down, but I still think it sounds really cool.
No, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like, a rebel group at the Medio School for Girls, like, yeah. Yes, please.
It's about, like, overthrowing the government and stuff, too, but it's just, like, there's so much going on in this one book.
That's awesome. Next up on our list is Miss Meteor, co-written with Anna Marie McLemore. This came out in 2020. It's about Lita, who wants to enter a beauty pageant despite not being your typical beauty queen, and her ex-best friend, Chicky, wants to help her. This sounds very Dumplin-esque.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. And I thought, like, this one in particular you would probably like because it just sounded... It sounded cool, and I like that they're ex-best friends, and, like, they have to work through that because they have a common goal. And I think it's a lot about friendship and accepting yourself, and, like, we could all use more books like that.
Oh, yeah. All right, and the next book is Lucha, which comes out next year in 2022. The YA fantasy novel follows Lucha Moya, a bounty hunter living on the border of an ancient mythical forest, the only source of a highly addictive drug that's destroying her community and her family. As the first member of her community in a generation to possess magic, she vows to defeat the evil that surrounds her.
Doesn't that sound awesome? Like, okay, sure.
As you can tell as I'm reading it, I'm like, what is this magic? Like, what is going on? But yeah, like, an ancient mythical forest that is the only source of a highly addictive drug that's that right there.
Yeah.
Book series. Let's go.
Right? There's another one later on. I don't remember who wrote it. That's also about a forest that's much creepier than this. Mm. And I just love forests that are, like, kind of alive and stuff, although that can be very scary, too. Don't go out in them at night, but...
Yeah. I can see that. You're also a mushroom forager, so...
I am.
I can understand your affinity for forests.
Yes, definitely. I should write a book about magical mushroom people.
I mean...
Why haven't I?
That's more of the question here. Is how has that not been a thing yet?
Time.
Yeah.
And energy.
Someday. Right, add it to the list.
Yeah.
And lastly, there are, again, a lot of short stories and anthologies. Keep an eye out. But yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, Gracie Kim is next. Gracie Kim wrote the Gifted Clan series, and I would like to say that, yes, the final book in the Gifted Clan series is called The Last Fallen Realm. I saw it on her website. I remember we were like... We found it on that wiki page, and I was like, is it real? I think it's real, but I'm not sure. Yes, it's real. So,
just a quick aside.
Yes, definitely. Now, here's the thing. Gracie hasn't written anything else,
aww,
but she has some fun facts on her website, and they were so cool that I was like, we have to talk about it anyway.
Hey, so I'm game.
Yeah, so in a previous life, Gracie was a diplomat for the New Zealand Foreign Service, a cooking show host, and once ran a business that turned children's drawings into cuddly toys.
I've seen that last part.
Really?
Like, I remember you could send in your child's, it was like an online business, that you could send in a drawing your child did, and they would either turn it into, like, a 3D version of it, or they would, like, print the picture on, like, a stuffed animal or something.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I swear that at least one of my friends had one of their child's drawings made into...
That's cool. Yeah.
So, like, I've heard of this concept before.
Interesting.
Yeah. No, that's cool, though.
Yeah. Now, she also lists 5 fast facts about herself, and I'm going to read them verbatim. Some of them are really interesting. Okay, first one. I ran away with the circus when I was 16 years old because I fell in love with a Colombian tightrope walker. True story. What is her life?
If she doesn't start writing romance...
Right
now.
That would
like,
be cool.
I mean, that would be a cool YA romance.
Yeah,
but like,
definitely.
You could write an adult romance about running away to the circus.
Also, kids, don't run away to the circus.
Although, I know 2 other people in my life who ran away to the circus, and it turned out well for them.
Did you? Do you really?
Yeah. One was my college professor, who ran away to be a trapeze artist, and it turned into all kinds of crazy good things for her. She's now a... She's still teaching at my school, I'm pretty sure. But she also jumps out of planes. She's a competitive skydiver, so yeah.
Okay.
And that's how she met her husband. And they have a cat. It's very cute.
Okay.
She's awesome. Her name is Montana, so I mean,
that is pretty cool.
Yeah, she's just an awesome human. And the other is a girl who went to my high school. She ran away and joined the circus. She was a saxophonist and wanted to do that for a while. And
okay.
She did a lot of different jobs in the circus. And yeah, it was just one of those things. She graduated high school and was just like, you know what? This sounds like fun. And
yeah,
ran away.
I always think about people running away to the circus being like an old-timey thing.
Mm-mm.
But apparently not.
It's still a thing.
Wow.
And I know she ran like the childcare there at one point, and she took on a whole different crazy range of jobs.
Yeah.
Like whatever was kind of necessary.
I mean, you have to have like some really cool experiences if you go work for the circus.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay, fast fact number two is one of my favorite things ever is the feeling of freshly cut fingernails. Yes, I'm weird. Okay.
I hate clipping my nails. Oh, I hate it so much. So it's interesting that some people like
it. Three, New Zealand is home, but I have also lived in South Korea, Spain, Taiwan, and China. Did you know that if you dig a hole in New Zealand, you'd come out on the other side in Spain? I did not know that.
That's one of those, like, weirdo fun facts.
Yeah.
Like, if you dug a hole from where you currently are, the opposite side of the world is not necessarily what you thought it
is.
Like, ours would probably be in the middle of an ocean,
probably.
I would imagine. I don't think we'd come out on land.
I'm
pretty sure we'd be in the middle of the Indian Ocean or something.
Fast fact number four, I am scared of big waves, the kind you find in the ocean, not in your hair. That's good. I'm also scared of waves and things. One time I was swimming in the ocean and a fish hook caught on my foot and I was up to my neck in water already and the waves kept going over my head and I had to pull my own foot out of the fish hook. Yeah, it was awful. I don't like the ocean as it is and that did not help matters. Yeah.
I haven't spent a lot of time in oceans, but I've liked them so far.
I'm glad you've had good experiences.
And I never will. No, I never will again. No, yeah. Most of my experiences with lakes and smaller bodies of water.
Yeah, I don't know. Water.
Although the Great Lakes are not small.
Yeah.
They look like oceans. I definitely grew up thinking they were oceans.
So yeah. Fast fact number five, I wrote my first story when I was 11 years old. It was called The Multicolored Club, and it was basically a mashup of The Spice Girls and The Babysitter's Club, Good Times. I would read that. I would 1,000% read that.
I mean,
can we get a sample of this, Gracie, please?
Did they sing? Like, were they singing?
That would be cool.
Like, a singing babysitters-esque kind of club. Like, even if they didn't babysit. Like,
yeah.
Even if they were just friends who hung out and had meetings and sang. Like, I'm totally,
into it.
Sounds delightful.
It does.
All right. Next up is Rebecca Roanhorse, who wrote Race to the Sun for the Rick Riordan Presents World. But in her spare time... has written quite a few things.
Yes.
The first is Star Wars Resistance Reborn, came out in 2019. In this journey to Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker novel, Poe Dameron, General Leia Organa, Rey, and Finn must struggle to rebuild the Resistance after their defeat at the hands of the First Order in Star Wars The Last Jedi. Anyone who's seen The Last Jedi knows what they're doing.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. All right, next up is The Sixth World, which is a four-book series, the first book of which is called Trail of Lightning. It came out in 2018. The next book, Storm of Locusts, came out in 2019. And then books three and four are as yet untitled and to be announced. So if you do check these out, know that the series has not been completed, and you may have some time to wait, depending on all of her other commitments. Because there is always Rick Riordan Presents, too. You never know. But Trail of Lightning is set after a climate apocalypse. Heroes and gods walk the earth, and so do the monsters. Maggie is a monster hunter who is enlisted by a small town to find a missing girl. This gives me...
the vibes of Race to the Sun. Well, the short story that she wrote is the Native American monster hunting
story. Which is cool.
Yeah.
But it also gives me vibes of that Dylan O'Brien movie.
Love and Monsters. Yeah.
It not the same, but like the idea that there's been an apocalypse, there are now monsters. I mean, in that movie, it was giant bugs.
Yeah.
But, like, there are monsters, and he, you know. Yeah. So, in this case, yeah.
Yeah. Go watch Love and Monsters. It's really, really
good. It's a really good movie. And it's kind of similar in description to this book.
I want to say this now, because as you'll see as we go on, I think she has some of the best titles. A lot of her titles have to do with weather and nature and stuff. And I think that they just sound so cool. Like, I would 100% pick up these books on the titles alone.
I do love a good weather story.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. You do disaster movies.
And anyone who's ever heard me talk about anything has probably heard about Roar.
Yeah.
By Cora Carmack. A book that I absolutely adore and that everyone needs to read and is going to be my life's ambition is to get everyone to read this book. I'm sure Cora appreciates it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay.
That was unpaid sponsorship.
Completely unpaid, I promise. The next series is called Between Earth and Sky. The first book of which is called Black Sun and came out in 2020. The next book in that series comes out in 2022 and is titled Fevered Star. Okay, here is the description for Black Sun. In the holy city of Tova, the winter solstice converges with a solar eclipse, promising to bring bad fortune. Making her way to the city aboard her ship, Shiala has the ability to calm the waters around her and warp a man's mind. Her only passenger is a man named Serapio, who is blind, scarred, and cloaked in destiny. When a man is described as harmless, he usually ends up being a villain.
This was another one that was really hard to pare down.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
Doesn't that sound so cool, though?
Yeah. No, it
like,
does.
Like, oh, man, I really want to read this.
That's a good name, too. Shiala?
Yeah, it's
and
cool.
And it's spelled with an X, so it's X-I-A-L-A. Like, that's just a really punchy name. There's not a lot of names that start with X, so immediately it kind of grabs your attention, like, oh.
Yeah, and I really like that line, when a man is described as harmless, he usually ends up being a villain. That is a killer line.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. No, I'm definitely there. Okay, the next series is A Tread of Angels. It was supposed to be released in 2021, but it hasn't come out yet due to all the craziness going
on. Yeah, probably.
So keep an eye out for it. I'm sure we'll probably get more about it in the near future. But it is described as a mystery based on the true story of the state of Sequoia becoming the 46th state of America in 1905, unifying five tribes around the area we know as Oklahoma, until a murder and theft of a train filled with gold threatens its fledgling government. I mean,
yeah.
I will say, I tend to not read books set in the past. Mm-hmm. I tend to be more of a contemporary or futuristic reader. But, like, some books that are set in the past that feel futuristic because it's so well placed in the past that it just feels like a new world.
Yeah.
So it almost feels futuristic. And this kind of, you know, like, it's so historical and, you know, interesting, and it's such a different world from the one I'm familiar with. It feels like it could be something like that.
Yeah, that's why I like steampunk, because steampunk is both past and future at the same time. I actually do like reading historical stuff, but I am very bad at it. Like, it takes me a very long time to read them, so I try to go light on the historical novels because I'll be reading it for, like, months.
Well, and it's funny because I read a lot of contemporary and future stuff, but I love movies about previous times.
Yeah.
Like, I love epic romances and, you know, old historical kind of thing. Like, I love those movies. So I think it's just a balancing act for me. Rebecca Roanhorse has also had a few of her stories read by LeVar Burton on his podcast. So here are three of those titles. There may be more, but these are three for sure that we know exist in the world, read by LeVar Burton, who has an amazing voice for that sort of thing. The first is Wherein Abigail Fields Recalls Her First Death and Subsequently Her Best Life. A young black girl in 1880s New Mexico Territory seeks vengeance, risking life and love in the process. I mean, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
The second is The Take Back Tango. A teenage thief embarks on a mission to reclaim her people's sacred treasures. And the last one is Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience. A tour guide leads virtual reality experiences for tourists who want to know what it's like to be Native American. Think Black Mirror meets Westworld.
Yeah, I've actually heard of that one before. Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience. I would probably say that, like, it's one of her most popular ones. By the way, I will be linking to all of the episodes of him reading these short stories. They're, like, on Apple Podcasts, so you can go listen to them.
Very cool, very cool. Rebecca's also written some Marvel comics and short stories and anthologies, like everyone else. So, yeah, lots out there.
Yes, for sure. Okay, next up is Sarwat Chadha, who wrote City of the Plague God. And his first series is The Templar Chronicles. Devil's Kiss came out in 2009, and then it was followed by Dark Goddess in 2010 and The Templar's Curse in 2021. So there was a little bit of a gap between those. Devil's Kiss is about Billy Sangreal, who is destined to follow her father into the Order and protect the masses from the unholy, thousands of evil, tortured souls that prey on humanity. So, Templar Knights, right? Templar Knights?
Yeah, I think they're called.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. I would read that.
Mm-hmm.
He also wrote a 39 Clues book. Now, I know Rick, I think he kicked off the 39 Clues book series, and that was another one that was like every author wrote a different book.
Sure.
This is the 39 Clues Double Cross, so I think it's a completely different series from that original one, and there have been other 39 Clues series. He wrote the fourth one, Mission Atomic, which came out in 2016. He also wrote the Ash Mystery Chronicles. Is that how you would say that? Mystery, M-I-S-T-R-Y? That's...
It sounds like mystery, but yeah, it's mystery.
When I said it out loud, it sounded weird, but I assume that's... Yeah. So Ash Mystery is the main character, and this is a trilogy, and it's Ash Mystery and the Savage Forest, which came out in 2012, The City of Death in 2012, and The World of Darkness in 2013. The first one is about Ash traveling to India with his uncle, who works for the mysterious Lord Savage. But Ash knows something is wrong, and he must stop Savage before he opens the iron gates, which have kept Ravana, the Demon King, at bay for 4 millennia.
Every time I hear Ravana, I think of a little princess, because Ravana, in her story that she's talking, like she's telling in the movie, Ravana is like the bad guy in that.
That makes sense.
So it every time I hear, like, you know, it just takes me back to that movie, and I'm like, yeah. Oh, man. But yeah, no, sounds very cool.
Yeah. So there was another series called Spirit Animals, Fall of the Beast. This actually might be another one where I think there's multiple Spirit Animals books. Not 100% sure on that. I've looked at a lot of books over the last couple of days. But Sarwat wrote the eighth one called The Dragon's Eye. The series is basically about the world of Urdas, where every child must discover if they will summon a spirit animal, a rare and incredible gift. The Dragon's Eye is about four young green cloaks who have been captured by the Oathbound, only to be smuggled away to a remote palace where they realize someone has been manipulating them all along. There's a lot going on in this series, I'm not gonna lie, but it sounds kind of cool. It gives me slight Animorph vibes, but like not the same, because they don't turn into the animals. But
sure.
It's still like young books.
It's like
with
Animorphs
animals.
Meets Patronuses.
Yeah,
kind of.
Yeah.
A little bit.
So he also wrote a comic book series called Shikari Force Hunters. This actually sounds pretty cool. The official synopsis says, meet the Shikari Force Hunters. There's Nil, an assassin and demon hunter who's dating Mina, the daughter of a demon. There's Jimmy, a brilliant scientist who's not sure if he's going to save the world or destroy it. And finally, there is a renegade goddess from the Age of Legends. This team of misfits is out to hunt and destroy the Nagas, an ancient serpent race who want to reclaim Earth from humanity with a diabolical secret weapon. Pretty sure the Nagas were in the Arusha books, too.
Okay. I was going to say that sounds familiar, and I haven't read Arusha, but I've heard enough, you know, in passing that it sounded familiar.
And again, Sarwat has written a lot of short stories and a lot of anthologies, so look out for those.
Next up is Laurie M. Lee, who wrote Pahua and the Soul Stealer. The first series we're going to talk about is The Gates of Thread and Stone, the first book of which is the same title, came out in 2014. The second book is called The Infinite, which came out in 2015, and book three is still kind of a question mark, but as far as we know, there will be a book three, so keep an eye out for that. But The Gates of Thread and Stone is described as follows. Kai can manipulate the threads of time, and when her brother goes missing, she gets caught up in a revolution centuries in the making.
I mean, it sounds pretty cool. Yeah. Like,
especially if you're interested in like time travel and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I saw somewhere on Goodreads where somebody asked about the third book, and basically Lori said that she definitely plans on writing it, but like she's just got a lot going on, as we will see. So yeah, who knows when it comes out, but there is still plans to like finish the series, I guess.
Good to know. The next series is called Shamanborn. The first book of which is called Forest of Souls, came out in 2020. The second book is called Broken Web and came out in 2021. And book three is as yet untitled, but is scheduled to come out in 2022. So I'm sure you'll hear more about that soon. The first book, Forest of Souls, is described as Saoirse has trained to become the queen's next royal spy. But when shamans attack and kill her best friend, she somehow restores them to life. It's revealed she's the first soul guide in living memory, and so she meets with the Spider King to learn how to restrain the untamed Deadwood, a forest possessed by souls.
There's the forest I was talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. This description is crazy. There's so much going on in this description.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds really cool.
I do love the idea of, like, a soul guide. Like, that's new and fresh and really cool. Love that. Love it, love it. And, like everyone else, Lori has a lot of short stories in anthologies, including 1,000 Beginnings and Endings, which we already talked about with Roshni Shakshi.
Yeah, so they both did a short story for that collection.
Nice.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Next up, we have Roseanne A. Brown, who wrote Serwa Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting. Her first series, which we actually talked about last week, I think it was, because the second book just came out, was A Song of Wraiths and Ruin, which that is also the title of the first book, came out in 2020. And then A Psalm of Storms and Silence came out in 2021, this year. So A Song of Wraiths and Ruin is about a vengeful spirit who abducts Malik's younger sister. So Malik strikes a deal to kill Karina, the crown princess, to set her free, to set the little sister free. Karina wants to resurrect her mother and requires the beating heart of a king. So she offers her hand in marriage to the victor of the Solstacia competition.
Conceivably with the intention of cutting out his heart.
Yes, exactly.
That sounds fair.
Yeah. So intense. Ooh. These covers, by the way, are some of the most beautiful covers I've ever seen in my life. They are absolutely gorgeous. I would 100% pick up this book based on the cover alone. I know you're not supposed to do that.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure I've seen A Psalm of Storms and Silence recently and thought the same thing.
Yeah, like, they're just stunning. Now, Roseanne has also written Shuriken T'Challa Into the Heartlands graphic novel coming out in 2022, which we both love Shuri. We both love T'Challa. I think it's so cool that she got to write a graphic novel.
Right. I mean, I've seen so many YA authors being allowed and able to write in like the Star Wars universe and the Marvel universe lately, and even like some of the big Disney universes with like the Fractured Fairy Tales and like that sort of thing that have been coming out. And I just, it's got to be so exciting to like get the opportunity to write a graphic novel about Shuri and T'Challa. Like, that had to have been like really, really cool.
Yeah. And I think like, I mean, it makes sense because Marvel and Star Wars are both Disney, and like that's probably what helped them get the Rick Riordan Presents stuff, because it's all within the same family,
I would imagine.
But yeah, it's really cool. And actually, speaking of that, she also wrote in the Stories of Jedi and Sith anthology, and so did Sarwat Chadha. So they've both done, and we've talked before, there's a couple other ones on here. I actually think it's Daniel Jose Older who recently wrote a Star Wars book as well, or something of the sort. So, like, yeah, there's just been a lot of Star Wars going around. So if you like Rick Riordan Presents and Star Wars and Marvel, you are in the right place.
For sure. Next up on our Happy Hit Parade is Daniel Jose Older, who has written Ballad and Dagger, which we talked about, but has not come out yet.
Has not come out yet.
I was going to say, I didn't think it had.
All this is the YA book.
That we're really excited about. Yeah. Oh, gotcha. Okay. The first series is called Shadow Shaper Cipher. The first book is entitled Shadow Shaper, came out in 2015. The second book is Ghost Girl in the Corner, which came out in 2016. Then comes Dead Light March in 2017, followed by Shadow House Fall, also in 2017. And then finally, Shadow Shaper Legacy, which came out in 2020. Whew, that's a lot of books.
Yeah.
The first book is described, here we go. A zombie crashes the first party of the summer. Sierra's comatose uncle keeps saying lo siento over and over, and graffiti murals keep weeping. Sierra discovers the Shadow Shapers, a supernatural order that connects with spirits via paintings, music, and stories.
Sounds pretty cool. Yeah. I love stuff about art.
That sounds really cool. Yeah.
And honestly, like, Ballad and Dagger, was this the one... I don't want to speak out of turn, but I feel like this was the one where it was like he was a piano prodigy or something like that. And like, it feels a lot of these books, you can tell why they've written the Rick Riordan Presents books. A lot of them have similar threads, which I actually really love because you could just tell they're passionate about writing these kind of stories.
Yeah, no, I agree. The next book or the next series we're going to talk about is Bone Street Rumba. A three-book series. The first is called Half Resurrection Blues, which came out in 2015. The second book is Midnight Taxi Tango, which came out in 2016. I just really like that title. Yeah. That's so cool. And the third one is Battle Hill Bolero, which came out in 2017. Half Resurrection Blues is about Carlos de la Cruz, who is one of the New York Council of the Dead's most unusual agents, an in-betweener, partially resurrected from a death he barely recalls suffering, after a life that's missing from his memory. He thinks he is one of a kind, until he encounters other entities walking the fine line between life and death.
And this series is an adult series, so it's not YA. Yeah. It is strictly an adult series. So if you're looking for that kind of thing, it sounds really interesting and weird. So
it definitely does. I mean, I'm not usually a big, like, undead kind of person.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I guess I watch a lot of vampire stuff, but but
they are different from zombies.
It's a little different, but this does sound kind of, you know, fascinating, and I do like that it's an adult series. Like, sometimes it's nice to mix it up. The next series is Dactyl Hill Squad. The first book is entitled Dactyl Hill Squad, came out in 2018. The second book, Freedom Fire, came out in 2019, and the third book, Thunder Run, came out in 2020. Dactyl Hill Squad's description is as follows. It's 1863, and dinosaurs roam the streets of New York as the Civil War rages between raptor-mounted armies down south.
This is a middle grade series, in case that wasn't obvious. I mean, I guess it could be something else, but very middle grade.
I mean, dinosaurs are awesome.
Sounds bonkers.
Dinosaurs are cool, and raptors are freaky, so, you know. I get it. I definitely get it. Next up is a Star Wars book, which we just talked about briefly a second ago, called Last Shot. Came out in 2018. It's a Han and Lando novel, so you can imagine, you know.
There are some shenanigans, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, most people talk about who shot first, so the last shot is kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Maybe the first shot doesn't matter so much.
Yeah, the last shot does.
Is the one that does. Yeah, it's kind of cool. And he also wrote The High Republic Adventures, which came out in 2021. And it seems to be a series of comic books, graphic novels, but takes place in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, not going to lie, this part confused me a little bit because there were a whole bunch of stories and issues and... There was a lot, so...
Issues make you think comic books.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to nail it all down. Trust me, okay. Next up is The Book of Lost Saints, which came out in 2019 and appears to be a standalone. And the description is as follows. Marisol vanished during the Cuban Revolution, her fate unknown and lost to time. Now, haunted by atrocities long forgotten, her foul-mouthed spirit visits her nephew, Ramon, in modern-day New Jersey. Her hope that her presence will prompt her descendant to unearth their painful family history.
I like that she's a foul-mouthed spirit. Like, that's just gotta be kind of fun.
Right, yeah. I mean, well-behaved spirits are
boring.
Super lame! Okay, next up is Flood City, which came out in 2021. Flood City is the last inhabitable place left above the waters that cover Earth. The chemical barons circle overhead in spaceships, wanting to return to Earth, while the Star Guard keep their control over the city. Max from Flood City and Ato, a young chemical baron, will find their paths colliding as the battle continues.
Again, had to be very succinct on that one.
I like it, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very Waterworld.
I know, that's what got me excited. I love Waterworld.
Which is such a weird movie.
It is.
But this kind of sounds, like, not too far off of that.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting, very interesting. And Daniel has also written other novellas, collections, and anthologies that all, you know, they exist in the world.
Yeah. Okay, we are two from the end. So we are getting there. We are close. Next up is Stacy Lee, who's going to be writing the Winston Chu versus the Whimsies book. Now, I've actually heard of Stacy Lee beforehand because her book, The Downstairs Girl, which came out in 2019, blew up. I feel like that book was everywhere. So that's pretty cool. And I actually didn't know what it was about. And I have a copy of it. Had no idea what it was about until I did this. And I actually really love the sound of it. By day, Jo is a lady's maid, but by night, she's an advice column writer. Her column becomes wildly popular, and she starts to address issues of race and gender. While the masses clamor to uncover her real identity, she chases down information about her own past.
Have you watched Bridgerton?
No, I haven't. Really?
Bridgerton has a woman, supposedly, writing a column anonymously, and no one knows who it is, and it causes all kinds of drama. Not necessarily issues of race and gender, but Bridgerton is very similar to some of this.
Okay.
And you're part of the mystery of Bridgerton is uncovering who's writing all this this column. So yeah, it's very similar.
Yeah, that's cool. I've been wanting to watch Bridgerton. I just haven't gotten around to
it. I'm reading this and I'm like... That is really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, very, very similar. Probably a different audience intended, because Bridgerton is a series of romance novels, so,
yeah,
like, it's a little older.
Yeah.
This might not be the same thing. But if you're looking for a, you know, different set of books, because Bridgerton's books are, you know, historical romance, so they can be a little more...
spicy?
Explicit? Spicy. Good word. Yeah. So this was probably a little more appropriate for,
yeah,
our younger readers.
Yeah. She also wrote Under a Painted Sky in 2015. In Missouri, 1849, Samantha wants to be a professional musician, but when an accident befalls her, she leaves for the Oregon Trail with a runaway slave named Anna May. Together, they disguise themselves as boys and find unexpected allies in a band of cowboys. This is what I mean. Like, I... historical stuff like this, like, this sounds so interesting. I really want to know what happens. And I like that they made friends with the cowboys.
I mean, yeah, always good fun.
In 2016, she wrote Outrun the Moon. In San Francisco, 1906, Mercy Wong bribes her way into a school usually reserved for wealthy white girls in order to get an education to help solve the poverty in Chinatown. When an earthquake strikes, she can't sit by while the city suffers. So, Stacy Lee likes writing historical novels. Just throwing that out there.
As I said, some people like, you know, contemporary and feature. Some people really like books that are set back. Even if it's fiction, even if it's, you know, not rooted in history, it's just a different way to escape, is,
yeah,
to go backwards into,
exactly,
worlds we all know fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 1906, you can already start to picture, like, what it looks like.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And especially when you're talking about, like, you know, somebody with Chinese heritage and all of that, like, going back and discovering those stories, I think is really important. Always, like, really interesting.
Agreed.
Luck of the Titanic came out in 2021. Valora tries to leave England to find a new life in America as a circus performer. She's running away to the circus, too. But she's turned away from the ship because she's Chinese. Instead, she finds her way on board, only to find herself fighting for her survival. So, kind of cool.
So she's Leonardo DiCaprio.
Maybe, yeah. Possibly.
No, I will say the... exception to my, I don't like to necessarily read a lot of things set in the past, would have to be, like, stuff about, like, the Titanic or...
Which is hilarious because I historically hate the Titanic movie so much.
But, like, I would also read something if it was set, like, around the Hindenburg, or there's something about those big monumental disasters that is interesting to then read fiction set near it or around it or, you know, related to it. Yeah. So.
They're going to say that someday about 9/11. Not to bring this down.
Yeah, it's
sorry, but it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Okay, in 2016, she wrote The Secret of a Heart Note. A teen uses her extra-sensitive sense of smell to mix perfumes that help others fall in love while protecting her own heart. Feels very Emma to me, doesn't it? Like somebody meddling, but like staying back out of the romance herself. I love stuff like this, by the way, that's like just a little bit of magic or just a little bit of like the extra sensory stuff. I think that's it's just really cool to keep it like mostly realistic with a touch of magic.
Yeah, that's always good fun.
Last one, last one.
Last one. Hey, that's me. I'm supposed to, okay, the last author on our list is Tracy Baptiste, who is writing Moco Magic, which we definitely talked about. The first series on our list is The Jumbies. The first book, The Jumbies, came out in 2015. The second book, Rise of the Jumbies, came out in 2017. And the last book, The Jumbie God's Revenge, came out in 2019. The Jumbies is a spine-tingling tale rooted in Caribbean folklore that will have readers holding their breath as they fly through its pages. Corinne Lemaire isn't afraid of anything. Not scorpions, not the boys who tease her, and certainly not jumbies. They're just tricksters parents make up to frighten their children. Then one night, Corinne chases an agouti all the way into the Forbidden Forest. Those shining yellow eyes that followed her to the edge of the trees, they couldn't belong to a jumbie. Or could they?
Or could they?
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. This is really interesting because, again, so Moco Magic is about a young Moco jumbie, a protective spirit who walks on stilts.
That's
so,
like, right. I was going to say it sounded familiar.
Yeah, it's very related. So obviously, like, she wrote this for a series and they were like, hey, that sounds amazing. You want to write some books for us? And she's like, yeah, obviously.
Let's just keep going. Right? Yeah. that's really cool. Tracy has also written the official Minecraft, an official Minecraft novel, entitled Minecraft The Craft, which came out in 2018. When a new virtual reality version of the game brings her desires and doubts to life, one player must face her fears.
I just love it. Totally random. Like, let's just throw in a Minecraft book.
I mean, so many people love Minecraft, yeah, so it doesn't surprise me. But why not Minecraft? I'll just throw it in there. The third book we want to talk about is Looking for a Jumbie, came out in 2021. Naya's mom says jumbies exist only in stories, so she sets out on a nighttime adventure to find out for herself. This is a picture book, so I'm guessing it's aimed a little younger.
Yeah, exactly.
And the next book on our list is Angel's Grace, came out in 2005, so a little bit... It's been a little while since that one came out.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, 2005, that's a little older. While visiting her grandmother in Trinidad, 13-year-old Grace sees a photograph of a stranger with a birthmark identical to hers and begins to wonder if the reason she feels different from the rest of her family is that he is her real father. And it's for ages 10 plus, so it's, you know, it's middle grade sliding into YA.
Yeah.
So it's a good age. Tracy has also written some nonfiction. A couple of examples, African Icons, 10 People Who Built a Continent, and also Who Wrote That, which is a series of novellas about a bunch of different authors' stories, like Stephanie Meyer, Madeline L'Engle, and Jerry Spinelli, etc.
Yeah, there were a bunch in there. I thought it was kind of interesting that she did that, and I read the description for the Stephanie Meyer one, and it was basically like how the idea came to Stephanie Meyer and how it got, you know, finished and how much of a success it was and stuff. And I think that those kind of books are always really interesting to me if you want to know more about the author and just, like, their process and stuff. So I think it's cool that she wrote those.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Man, okay, we did it. That was a lot. I think we did okay, though.
We did.
And all those books sound so interesting.
There are a lot, and there's a lot of variety. I mean, just based on different genres, different age groups, you know, all of that. There's a lot of writing out there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot.
And if you really like one of the authors from Rick Riordan Presents and really like the type of stories they tell, there are a lot of similarities, too. So, like, yes, there is a lot of variety, but if you really like reading about, you know, Hindu mythology and stuff, then you can go see Roshni's books and pick up more of them if you really like her writing style.
And while some of them seem to want to stick close, like Tracy Baptiste, who we just talked about,
yeah,
some of them also have written some wildly different things,
really
too.
Different things.
So it just depends on what you're in the mood for.
Yeah.
I hope you find a really great read.
Yeah. If you guys have read any of these books, let us know which ones have been your favorites. If you want us to start with a particular one, I would really like to pick up one of these, you know, somewhere if I can fit it into my crazy book schedule. It's probably not going to happen for a while, but I would really like to read some of these. So yeah, if you like any of them, let us know. If any of them really stick out to you, let us know. We love your feedback, so please give us some. Thank you.
Sincerely, Karen.
Yeah. Okay. These chapter reviews. You ready?
I think I might be ready.
Okay. Let's do this.
All right, here we go. So we are up to chapter 13, entitled, I Plunge to My Death. And this chapter is train ride time. Grover, Annabeth, and Percy are on an Amtrak train heading as far west as fast as they can. So they spend 2 days on the train. Grover basically is described as sleeping the whole time, or most of the time. And Annabeth is doing her best to make sure that his satyr self is covered, whether it's his hooves sliding his sneakers back on or his hat adjusting it every time he shifts his head right or left. Thank goodness Annabeth's on it, because Percy is not. He's not going to...
He's just pacing up and down the train being right? useless.
Watching out the windows, seeing all kinds of craziness. No. Percy and Annabeth do get to talking, though, and she divulges how her family, and specifically her father and stepmother, treated her before she came to Camp Half-Blood and basically never left. It's not good news, and it's definitely a bit of a downer, but it's really important, and it gets us to the heart of Annabeth and getting to know her a little better.
Yeah.
So that's good. They then visit the St. Louis Ark, where Echidna and her chimera son, who apparently, if I'm remembering correctly, was part lion, part goat, and part snake, which, no thank you.
Yeah. well put.
Attacks Percy. Attacks Percy. So, Percy jumps off the highest part of the arch, because of course, and yeah. That's where we end the chapter.
Yeah. Plummets to his not-so-deathly death.
His death?
Yeah. Question mark?
Question mark?
Yeah.
I have to just say, first of all, Ohio reference.
Yeah.
It's very brief, and it means nothing.
Well, but I love that, like, all these places that are like, they were out in the middle of nowhere. They were in a super bleak place. It must be Ohio.
It's either Ohio or, like, Idaho or Wyoming. Yeah. Like, one of those states that everyone's like, oh, yeah, it's in the middle, right? Yeah, that's...
Since I've moved to Ohio, it's been, like, 5 or 6 years now. I swear, like, several Marvel movies have had a thing take place in Ohio, and it always kind of gives me a thrill. Because I never would have, like, noticed that before. I would have just been like, Ohio. But now that I live here, I'm like, oh, Ohio.
Us native Ohioans, man. Anytime it's mentioned.
Yep.
There was an Ohio mention. It's usually not good.
Yeah, no, it's rarely good.
It's usually
good.
Talking about us like we're all hicks. We are not all hicks. There are many population centers in Ohio. I'm just saying. Cleveland, come on.
You had such a Schmidt look on your face and tone to your voice right then. It just slapped me in the face. That was so funny. I wish you guys could have seen that.
Oh, good times. Anyway. Moving on, because this is not...
We're getting delirious now.
Yes, it's late. It's really late.
I've broken Kristen.
Okay, get it together. Okay. So I think the first thing that I want to talk about is Annabeth's birth, because especially when it comes to the female gods, obviously they're the ones who carried the child, whether it's Athena and the birth is... different,
mm-hmm.
or like Hera or any of the other female, like they obviously have to birth the child because the father is not going to do it. and so it's interesting.
Although, didn't Zeus technically birthed Athena?
Did he? Oh, yeah.
Out of the top of his head, right?
Yeah,
Wasn't that how that worked?
Yeah. And hence Athena's children aren't born the same way we assume they are born. They're born a different way because that's how she was born.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of interesting. But no, I just getting into that and remembering that, like, while there's Percy's, where the godly parent is the man and they're basically, you know, given a human birth, you know, normal, yeah. There's also demigods of female gods, and their appearance in their father's lives is probably very different.
Yeah.
Probably a little more, less, they have a little less notice.
Yeah. Probably.
Have a lot less time to get used to the idea. So I can imagine that Annabeth just appearing on his doorstep and being like, you know, it sounds like Athena did inform him that she was, you know, going to have a child. But, like, at the same time, it's got to be a bit of a shock.
It was a shock.
Yeah. So I it was nice to be reminded of that. Mm-hmm. And get into that a little bit.
Yeah. I actually really liked this whole thing about Annabeth. I mean, like is not really the right word, because it's very sad, because I feel bad about Annabeth's relationship with her dad, although I know that as the series goes on, like, it does get better and we learn more about that, and I'm very interested to be reminded of what exactly happens there. But, yeah, I think whenever Annabeth shows any sort of vulnerability and opens up a little bit, I get just really excited. And especially because Percy and Annabeth in the beginning don't particularly get along. And I think that Annabeth especially is thinking about Athena and Poseidon and how they've never really gotten along historically. And Percy doesn't really have a lot of pride. He's kind of like, can we please just try to be friends? Like, this is crazy and a lot's going on and I just really need you by my side. And I really, really appreciate that coming from him, because he's a boy, you know, he could have a lot of pride. He could be obstinate and he's just trying to keep it together.
Yeah, I mean, truly. Plus, she's been, all encompassed in this world of Greek everything since she was 7 years old.
Yeah.
Like, she has not had a whole lot of experience outside of it. So it makes sense that she bases all of her interactions on, like, how her godly parent gets along with them. So it's nice that Percy, a child of Poseidon who just found out and is like, listen, I don't know what's wrong with your dad, with my dad and your mom. Like, that doesn't mean we have to do that. Like, let's, you know, find some common ground and get along. Like, that, yeah, it's really cool. I also wanted to point out, at the end of this chapter, when Percy is, like, contemplating the plunge he's about to make off the ark and into the water, he starts kind of questioning it, like, is Poseidon even there?
Yeah.
Like, he's the sea god, but he's not god of lakes and rivers, so clearly he's not gonna, you know, like, he can't help me. And it just kind of dawned on me, like, yeah, Poseidon is god of the sea, but does that mean he's, like, god of all water, or is it just salt water, so fresh water is outside of his purview? But clearly it's not.
Right.
Or he at least is on a good first name basis with the naiads or something, so yeah, that, like, he... he does have some influence in all bodies of water.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. One, because Percy stepped into the creek a couple of episodes ago. Episodes. Chapters. It was also a couple episodes ago. But, you know, and he was healed that way. So that was technically fresh water. Toilet water also.
Right?
Like, he had power over that.
Definitely not salt water.
Yeah. I think, I don't remember if this is in the book or not, but I want to say something about rivers especially, like how they travel to the ocean eventually. So it makes sense that they're still all connected. I think that there are different creatures and, like, minor gods and goddesses that have more domain over some of those other areas, but I do think Poseidon, because he's, like, a primary god,
mm-hmm,
he has power over pretty much all water, yeah, I think.
Which is just good to know.
Yeah, good for Percy.
For Percy's sake.
Yeah, especially. I would also like to point out that prophecy count 4, question mark? I mean, he had another dream. And
yeah.
We were counting the dreams, so...
I say it counts.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to have a lot of prophecy count numbers by the end of this.
Yeah, they do start to kind of jump up here in a while, too. So, yeah. Okay. I think that pretty much wraps up the major events of this chapter, the big stuff. So let's go on and do our favorite quotes. I will go first, because mine is actually not from any of our heroes. It's from the Echidna, who says, I hate it when people say that. I hate Australia. Naming that ridiculous animal after me. For that, Percy Jackson, my son shall destroy you. And I just love that, for that, my son shall destroy you. Like, yeah, she wasn't already there to destroy him.
I know.
Like, you didn't make this decision.
Yeah.
Like, I know you're mad, but And echidnas are cute. I don't know what's her problem, what her problem is. She's not cute, but the Australian, you know, animal, the echidna is cute.
I actually really like this scene in general, and actually it goes with my quote too, because the chihuahua turning into the chimera is just hilarious. It is so funny, and I just love the way the mist like warps things, and like I don't know if that was just the mist or if that was like part of the chimera's like ability or echidna's ability or whatever, but basically the chimera emerges and starts to set everything on fire, and Percy's thinking to himself, great, I thought we just blowtorched a national monument. And it was so funny to me in that moment. It was great.
Yeah.
Typical Percy humor.
For sure. And I'm just sitting here, like, reading this chapter, picturing someone blasting a hole in the top of the arc, the St. Louis arc, like, arch.
Yeah.
St. Louis arch. It you can kind of see it in your head, and you're like, wow. Like, yeah, that would be kind of a big deal. I thought it was funny that our quotes in this very long chapter came, like, within 50 words of each other. Like, it was really close together. I thought that was funny. But now let's move on to our favorite moments. For me, it was Percy noticing all the unusual creatures out the window. Like, I don't know if he's always noticed these things and he's just now telling us, you know, like, talking about it. But it might be that he's officially starting to see through the mist first. Like, he always has. But, like, just that, you know, that knowledge that taking a train across the countryside, he's seeing all of these, like, really odd Greek creatures that, you know, we look out our window and see cows or horses, but they may not be cows and horses. That could be the mist. Like, yeah. It's just kind of cool.
I think that it is, because wasn't it in the beginning of the book that's like, if you don't know anything about this, don't read on, because now you can't unsee it. I think that's basically happening to him, is now he knows that there's something else out there. So while he may have been able to see through the mist before in a way that he couldn't comprehend, now he knows what it actually means, so he can see things like the centaurs instead of horses and stuff like that. So yeah, I think that makes sense.
It's very fun, though.
My favorite moment was the explanation that all rational people are afraid of the dark, because, yes, like, I totally agree with that. The dark is very scary. But it's because Hades can become shadow and radiate fear so intense it can drive you insane. And I just, like, I've talked about this a million times before, but just explanations about how mythology influences, like, our reality and how this world is built and how things operate within it. I really like that, and I thought this was a really cool explanation. Yes, Callie, we hear you. We're almost done.
So close. I, too, have a slight fear of the dark. I rather like the dark, but I do not like the dark, like pitch black, you can't see it. That is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
Like abysses, like when I'm playing a video game that's set underwater, and anytime I have to go out into the water, like, and have nothing to see out there, it's just an abyss, that freaks me out, which I know is an actual
phobia.
Yeah. Like, I know it has a proper name and all that, but it's terrifying. So the dark definitely has its creepy factor, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to chapter 14, entitled I Become a Known Fugitive. Funny enough, this chapter is rather short. It's only like 4 or 5 pages.
Yeah.
But my recap is no shorter.
It is very long.
I'm trying, I swear. I'm trying to be brief.
Now you know how I feel.
Okay, so Percy survives. Yay! He slowly processes what's going on around him in the murky waters of the Mississippi. He's sort of taking stock of what kind of power he has when he's underwater. Anything that touches him is instantly dry, he can breathe, etc. He then gets a message from a mysterious underwater visitor who appears to look like Sally, his mother. He's supposed to go to Santa Monica before looking for the entrance to the underworld, amongst other things. He then surfaces to a lot of commotion following the whole, you know, blasting a hole into the side of the National Monument thing. He, Annabeth, and Grover slip into their train and head for Denver to avoid the craziness that's going on behind him, especially considering he is an actual fugitive and his name is being broadcast on every news broadcast across America at this point.
Yeah. I really liked this chapter, even though it was short, because I really like the visual of Percy in the water, I think that it's so easy to imagine. And it is, I like when authors do this, when you have like action, 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 and then you have a short chapter that kind of brings things down and lets you reflect on stuff, because in the middle of all that action, the main person, especially a 12-year-old boy, has just gone through a lot of stuff. And you need to, like, think about that stuff for a while and what it means to you. And him sitting at the bottom of the river just being like, all right, this is my life now. Like, I just really appreciate moments like that.
And I think Percy needs it, too. It's a moment of quiet. Like, he's in the water and he's probably not... He doesn't have to hear anything. Like, he's in his little bubble and he's just kind of there. And... considering all of the chaos that's going on around him, it's probably like, you know what? This isn't so bad. I'll just stay here a second, take a deep breath in my bubble. Yeah, but no, I agree with you. It's a good, it's just a good moment to kind of take stock of everything that just happened and with Percy, take a breath. I also liked that in the bubble, he took the time to kind of assess the power that water gives him as he's, like, realizing, like, I can breathe, as a last observation, of course, because he's Percy. But, like, oh, things are dry, like, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I like that he's taking the time to kind of say, okay, this happened, this could happen again. Like, let me kind of see what I've got going on here. Just a really interesting and important idea. Like, he needs to know what he has at his disposal, or he won't know what he can do in a fight and what he can do to survive. Okay, the other thing I wanted to talk about was who do we think this underwater lady that looked like Sally was?
I don't remember.
Okay, I didn't know if we were supposed to. Like, maybe it's just a naiad who has Sally's coloring and, like, looks like Sally.
Maybe. I feel like it also almost felt like a vision, like somebody's using Sally's, like, visage to talk to him, because maybe, like, he'll be more comfortable or something like that.
Which would make sense.
Yeah.
And being in the water, they probably can manipulate the light to look however they
possibly
want. So if it
yeah.
was a naiad, like, they may have that ability to kind of change their appearance underwater.
Right.
So, we'll leave it at that for now, but if anybody else has an answer to this and, like, we forgot, you know, like, something that they talk about later or something.
I want to say that they'll probably bring it up later, like, with an explanation, but yeah, not 100% sure.
Maybe Chiron has an, you know, might know.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. But, we'll get to that if it comes up again. And, yeah, poor Percy is a super wanted man.
So wanted.
Like, wanted
wow.
boy.
Yeah.
He's not even a man.
No.
Poor Percy.
12-year-old boy. Yeah, I actually found the end of this chapter interesting for a different reason, because the woman actually saw the fire-breathing chihuahua, which means she saw through the mist, and I want to say probably because it was, like, a direct attack.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious if, like, there could be another reason why she saw through the mist, because we know some humans have more of a proclivity for seeing through it, like Rachel Elizabeth Dare, but, yeah, I just, that kind of stuck out to me a little bit.
This kind of leads into my favorite moment, so we're going to go there next.
Okay.
Because my favorite moment was the kid seeing Percy getting out of the water and was completely dry. And I kind of wonder if that might be a little bit of mist too. Like, it's not as clear because it's not like a creature or something that's being hidden. But since it is, like, abnormal, I wonder if maybe because it's a child and they maybe have the ability to see through the mist a little easier, that the adults may have seen him and he'd look a little wet or look a little scraggly. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I thought it was an interesting observation. And I liked that the kid was, like, tugging on his mom.
Yeah.
Like, look at this. And she's
That's
just like,
nice,
sure.
Honey.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually was going to write that down first because I had the exact same thought. And then I kind of thought about it a little bit more. And I was like, well, I think it's just an observation that he came out of the water and he's dry. Although that is a good question. Like, would the mist make him look wet? Or is that not as big of a deal for the mist to, like, deal with? Because it's too busy covering up chihuahuas and chimeras and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's just one of those questions that lingers. And
yeah.
Something to think about.
Yeah. My favorite moment was Percy realizing he can breathe underwater. Because again, like you said, it was almost an afterthought, which I thought was really funny. But also, has he never noticed this before? Like, genuine question, because I assume as a 12-year-old boy, he's gone swimming before. So does that mean that he's never, like, tested it out? Which could be the case. Maybe he just assumed he couldn't. And so... never did.
I'm thinking about it, and as a boy who's gone through a lot of different schools and moved a lot, and I'm curious, maybe he hasn't had a lot of opportunities to swim, like, for, you know, joy of it. Yeah. He's probably taken baths, which, as he was a younger kid, like, may not have noticed it or didn't make note of it, but it's definitely interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and that could have been, that also might have been... an ability that could have developed a little bit later on. So maybe he couldn't do it when he was younger, but especially now that he's been claimed, he can do it.
Yeah. No, that's for sure. Yeah. Very true. Very true. Okay. And now we can do our favorite quotes. Mine is more of an exchange, but I had to do it because it's so funny. Annabeth says, "We can't leave you alone for 5 minutes. What happened?" Percy says, "I sort of fell." And Annabeth says, "Percy, 630 feet?
Yeah. I really like this exchange, too.
It's just classic. Like, Percy, like, I sort of fell.
Yeah.
You fell from the top of the St. Louis Arch. Like, no, you didn't sort of fall.
Yeah.
You jumped out of a hole. Like
5 minutes he was left alone and just everything fell apart. Yeah.
What was yours?
My favorite quote was when the river lady said, "Do not trust the gifts." I know that this isn't really like a funny line or anything, but I found it so intriguing and mysterious, and it really just makes you go, what? What's going on? And obviously it's huge foreshadowing, so I really like that he planted that so early.
Yeah, it's like a borderline prophecy, not a prophecy, but just enough foreshadowing. She
has knowledge and... yeah, probably can't intervene too much, but also, like, wants to help Percy out.
And that wraps up our discussion of these two chapters of Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. Next week, we will be up to chapters 15 and 16. So make sure you read those and get ready for that discussion. All right. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. If you're looking for our episodes, you can find them on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, so that would be great. You can leave us questions and comments on any of those places, plus ideas for content you might want to see or anything like that. Next week, we'll be diving deep.
Oh, nice.
into Daughter of the Deep for a spoilery review and discussion. So if you haven't read it and want to listen to that episode right away, you've got a week to do so. So get reading.
Yeah. Also, thanks to one of our listeners who wrote in, we actually have timestamps on our episodes now. So if you wanted to skip the main discussion and just like go right to the chapter discussions, if you haven't read Daughter of the Deep yet, then hopefully that'll make it a little bit easier for you.
All right. And with that, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.